The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Good morning, and you're on the Deadline Report with Ben Vidge Investigates, Kira Fresh FM, the greatest little radio station broadcasting on Nelson 107.2. Nelson and Tasman 104.8, Eastern Golden 95.0, Benham 88.9, or you can listen to us here or Fresh FM's own website, or you can find me on the Dyslexic Detective, care of postmanproductions.com. Dyslexic Detective, possibly going to be very shortly turned into the Deadline Report as we try and get everything a bit consensus. Remember, if you are interested in actually supporting us, get in contact with me, mediadownunder@gmail.com. And basically let me know that you'd be keen to run an advert or put in a little bit of a donation, because this is how we keep independent media running alive. And trust me, the lights are burning very, very thin these days in genuine independent media. I like to make this point about independent media because there's a lot of people out there that try to make out like they're alternative platforms, and they kind of, it's not even about whether you believe them or not, but things like QAnon and MAGA, and again, we're going to be talking about Counterspin, because they like to make out they're alternative media, but when you're actually trying to run to get political office, you kind of can't wear two hats at once. So you've either got to decide you're a journalist or you're a politician, because basically if you're doing something to get people to vote in a certain way, it's not journalism, it's propaganda. Now, having said that, on that note, I brought that old counter stink, as I like to call Counterspin, up today, because they've been making lots of claims about the Christchurch shooting, and they've said they brought in an expert to do a forensic investigation of the video, and that the person in question was also, they brought in peer review from academics in Thailand. Now, I haven't seen who these academics in Thailand are, but or where they are supposedly, but we'll be following up that one, sure enough. But as far as the expert that they're talking about, you know, he's talking basically about how the recoil on the rifle, you know, means that they're actually, it's not a real firing, real ammunition. It's actually an airsoft gun. A couple of points about that claim, why it's completely nonsense. If you're a forensic expert, you're a forensic expert of digital. You're not a forensic expert of guns. You can't, again, that's trying to confuse people with the actual kind of expertise you are, when in actual fact, it's kind of like apples and oranges are both fruits. It doesn't make all oranges apples. Now, the second aspect about that is that, as far as I'm aware, and feel free anyone out there to correct me if I'm wrong, but this guy's meant to be a digital expert, but he doesn't make any reference to actually what kind of technology the shooter was actually using on, that's the shooter, Brenton Tarrant from Brisbane, on the day of March 15th. He doesn't make any reference about the type of video equipment that he's using, which is very important if you're actually going to understand what's going on with the camera equipment forensically, which is supposedly what this guy is meant to be, a forensic expert, but he's, you know, said, you know, he's not saying, well, actually it's a GoPro 400, and if you try to set it down to maximum settings so that you can do as much footage as possible, because that's what the shooter was trying to do, is trying to get as much footage as possible, what happens is it becomes very, very grainy, and the auto function basically kicks in. So what happens is it suddenly looks like weapons are firing out of the weapon, and then they're disappearing in mid-air, and basically it's kind of impossible to do any real meaningful forensics with that particular GoPro 400. And again, don't take my word for it. Go online, have a look at the GoPro 400's reputation. It's not a very particularly good one. Now, having said that, at the moment, I'm not going to let too much out of the bag, but there are some very, very good experts investigating this at the moment in Auckland University. What they're doing is they're studying the signature, or the writing styles of the shooter, Brenton Tarrant, when he wrote his manifesto. And they're looking for things like he makes the same kind of spelling mistakes, or puts the commas in the wrong place. All these things that we all do. We all have a very unique right way of writing. And these guys have been looking at it, and I've been coming up with some very interesting information. There's another academic who I'm not going to say where he is at this moment, but he actually is an Australian. He contacted me because he said, look, you know, I'm very curious about this whole issue about on page 391 of your book, State Secrets. This is the book I wrote in 1999 that basically became, we sold about 15,000 units. It was a bestseller and then some by New Zealand standards. We only got two actual reviews at that particular time, as Scoop said, the government literally put a media blackout on my publication. Didn't stop it from reaching the bestsellers list. But he talks about page 391, which is, this page also interested Mary Jolly, who works for Al Jazeera. And again, during her investigation, she did a very good breakdown on the shooter, which she put on Al Jazeera. And I gave her some help putting together a few connections. But she wanted to know about this particular page, 391. And where I am is I'm quoting a Zine called Peacelink. Now, PeaceLink is, and I'm making the point just to claim this very carefully, is I'm stating in 1999, hey, there's this guy called David Tipple, and he keeps on having, you know, he's having some very strange run-in with the law, and we've got this magazine over there that's, you know, stating that his Gun City was providing Chinese Norincos to the Contras, and that the Contras were far right-wing mercenary types that were active in Latin America in the 1980s. And what would happen, actually, Paul, David Tipple, I can't recall entirely if it happened before or after I wrote the book, but he eventually actually ended up spending a year in jail because what he was doing was he was going to the United States and taking weapons from Christchurch and selling them to these Yiha types in fairs in the United States, which is PeaceLink doesn't explain specifically the Contra Link, but I'm assuming that this is what he was doing, is taking some of the weapons that he was getting from Gun City, bringing them to the United States, selling them in these fairs, and he ran kind of wild of the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms, and he spent a year in jail. And so a lot of people have been very interested in David Tipple from that viewpoint. I said Mary Tolley, this academic, and there's lots of people looking into it, and I think you're going to find some quite interesting things coming out about, because again, what we discovered early on in the piece, or I said, I think, in fact, 24 hours before the ODT turned around and said it, was I said, well, guess what? David Tipple also provided the guns to David Gray, who was the mass shooter that was active down in Dunedin. Now, Dunedin, the active shooter down in Dunedin, David Gray, he was also in the habit of collecting these magazines that were Soldier of Fortune, and he was also very active in collecting magazines that were affiliated with Fight Time. It's a little shop that sort of provides sort of martial arts and stuff to kind of, it goes out to all the hand-to-hand combat people, but it's also run by Jeff Todd, who runs the Todd Group, that's active in Dunedin and trains mercenaries and has kind of interesting, you know, reputation when it comes to Fight Club kind of stuff. And they were one of the people that were very active in the Dunedin Rifle Club. So anyway, this particular contact, you know, he was interested in that. We started talking. And as I was talking to him, I sort of started to kind of realise a few other things that I'd actually forgotten about. And he, in turn, kind of gave me a bit of additional information about things that I wasn't entirely aware of at that particular time, which have now made me go, well, that kind of makes sense. And I'll just run you through, in brief, some of this stuff, because this is actually kind of, we're still working on this. And, you know, I said, I don't work it fast. I don't feel in the need to, you know, come up with the answer to a very complicated issue the week after it happened. You'll probably actually get a full written report. Will come out when my book is published. In probably about a year or time, so, but I don't want to go and give you too much details about that, but it is going to be quite exciting. And I will tell you that it's a lot to do with gods, guns, and gold. And they feature very, along with organized crime and lots of all sorts of exciting material. So, yeah, because some of these things they were talking about was, we're talking about he's working, you know, from the United States for the Official Information Act they got over there in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the OIA here, trying to get a lot more details on basically where Tarrant actually had been and what he was actually up to. And this guy was really good because they're saying, well, actually, one of the things about Brenton Tarrant that's very interesting was that, unlike there's a whole kind of like group of Australian neo-Nazis, many of them ex-soldiers like Ethan Telling, and they kind of make their way to places like Ukraine. And what they're actually doing, because of Australian laws, is they're not going to these sort of these areas, active war zones, directly. What they're doing is they're going to other countries first of all, and then applying through the consulate so that there's less of a chance of them being actually detected. And he sort of points out, well, he said, yeah, that's probably happening in the case of Asia and Pacific, but in the case of Ukraine, they don't actually need a visa to travel. And of course, we've got right now, we've got people like Ron Marks, New Zealand First, and they're making, you know, lots of trips. And you see on Ron Marks' you know, posts quite regularly about all the exciting things he's up to in Ukraine. At the same time that New Zealand's actually, you know, now talking about selling drones to Israel, which I kind of think is kind of interesting because if you kind of look at a little like the what they call the Azerbaijani laundromat, it also talks about New Zealand partnering up with Israel to provide drones to Azerbaijani dictators in that part of the world. And that's all on the Paradise Papers. And we also find in the Paradise Papers, there's lots and lots of reports basically about guns for oil, money being laundered through New Zealand banks, always with a very strong Israeli component. And again, these are all these sort of chickens that I've been maintaining for a long time, that basically what happened in Christchurch is that there is a bigger picture, there's a macro picture, and again, we won't get too far down that rabbit hole today, but basically what we're seeing is that New Zealand has got itself involved in some very, very dirty deals from the 1980s, involving a lot of Iran-Contra, a lot of very shifty, sketchy right-wing types, and a lot of these things are now coming back to bite us in the ass. And unfortunately, as we decide to kind of like, we have this triangle dance between, are we going to be a singular nation, or are we going to be a bicultural nation or a multicultural nation, all these three things keep contradicting, and they're kind of causing greater and greater destabilization impacts. And it's not about, I'm of opinion that we should really address the issue about co-governance, but this is not what I'm talking about here. This is a question of, because we've made dodgy deals in the past, now as we're trying to move forward as a country, we're getting ourselves entangled in all sorts of messes which we probably should have kept clear of to begin with. Again, we started talking a little bit about this, sort of the rifle club, and one of the things we were talking about was he makes the point that actually in the Royal Commission, the shooter actually emailed the rifle club before he even moved to New Zealand. So he first moved here in 2010, then he left and, went away and did all this trip where there's some quite huge holes which slowly we're filling in about where he is. And so that's why I'm saying, I don't really want to kind of say too much until we've filled out our jigsaw puzzle. But then he sort of came back here in approximately, I think it was 2016, 2017, but he emailed the Dunedin club and said he was interested in joining, and he makes the point, I always wonder why I chose Dunedin all our places to move so he could join that Pacific club. To give you a quick rundown, I said, this is a club that I had already been writing about. And from about 2015 to 2017, we were talking about some very sketchy types of people that were involved at this particular club. We were talking about also in Dunedin at that time, there was kind of a, I wouldn't say underground scene, but it was very, very low key. The Road Knights, which was, became a recruitment also. Well, they were recruiting people from things like Stormtroopers 88 and the National Front groups. So they were kind of a conduit from these skinhead groups into these kind of gang groups. And some of them had also very much links into the mixed martial arts, the sort of things that, Cash Patel's very, very excited about. I wonder if that's why he's coming to New Zealand to set up an FBI agent. He wants to get New Zealand involved in the mixed martial arts program he's got for the FBI. But I digress. So, they were sort of doing this thing. And a lot of these guys that were involved in these sort of like fight club sort of scenes were also, again, quite heavily involved in the Road Knights and the Southern Vikings, both of whom had basically very strong right-wing connections. So we find at this particular club, so this is kind of, this kind of stuff's going on. There's emailing them. I've already been writing about them between 2015 and 2017 saying, there's a bit of a gun problem, and it seems to be coming, the issue seems to be revolving around some of the people that are involved in these security clubs or consultancy firms that have links back to the Iran-Contra types in the 1980s. Some of it has to do with the same kind of clubs having connections to these kind of dodgy, sketchy motorcycle gangs, which we'll just move along from there. But then basically Peter Bedell turns around, who's a soldier, and he again is one of the several people that have come through and said, well, actually, this was before the event. He's saying there's something not right with this club. They've got, people, they've got targets, actual human targets there with fixed bayonets, looking like, they're kind of like might be sort of Asian or Slavic. They've got Confederate types. They've got some very sort of strange right-wing politics going on. And basically what happens in the Royal Inquiry is the police turn around and say, oh, no, that was Peter was a liar. And, they basically smear campaigned him with no actual right or reply. And, of course, it wasn't really strung out in the Royal Inquiry that the police that were kind of smearing him were the same police that had been sent to investigate the Dunedin Pistol Club, which is the one that turned around and said, I want to come and join you guys. Can you vet for me? Although we're having a bit of we're not having an argument, but there's sort of an issue there that I believe that the Pistol Club were providing vetting for Brenton Tarrant. My overseas contact seems to think it's a person that he met online gaming community, and we're actually flushing that a wee bit out because we think we might be speaking at cross purpose, and we think we may have just found another little tunnel to kind of piece things together through gaming clubs that effectively they were kind of like secret hangouts, if you like, online hangouts where these guys could turn around and discuss their things without anybody actually realizing that they actually were doing more than playing live shoot 'em up games. But we also know that at this club that they were contacted because he went and got a whole bunch of ammunition, and we know that the people that provided the ammunition were not very happy with what they saw, and we're kind of following up on that one as well, because we seem to think that when they tried to make their submission hearing on the Royal Inquiry, they again kind of got their communications interrupted, so they weren't able to kind of add to the picture that there was another red flag where the intelligence community had actually knew something, or should have known something was happening, but for some reason they just kind of missed the ball. Now, we'll just take a little bit of a break, and I think we will just go today with Armageddon Wars, which is the other. It's a nice, simple song, and we may have to come back and follow the rest of the story off next week, but I'll just do listen to the song while I do a quick time check and work out where we're at. And this is Ben Vigen on the Deadline Report.
The world is on its elbows and knees. It's forgotten
Deadline Report with Ben Vigin Investigates. Just carrying on from where we're at. So I'm talking to this particular very, very informative guy, and we've got a few more minutes. So I don't know if we're going to get to all to kind of do all the things, and we may have to kind of follow this up next week. And again, we're kind of come up, we're coming off this point. We're talking about, you know, what went on with the firearm application. Again, one of the things was that Brenton bought weapons online. And again, these are things that Silwyn Cushing of Rapid Fire complained about. I had talked about in my magazine Deadline, and the committee with, you know, all the people that were like hunters were going like, no, don't sell weapons online. That's causing a problem. We're not really comfortable with that. And you know, and they went ahead and did it anyway. And then again, afterwards, the people that were made, who made that mistake got turned into heroes. But one of the things we also kind of looked into was the issue about the firearms application. Yeah, here we are. The reference of the firearm applications was a friend he knew online gaming. If I remember that, the names of the people and policemen involved getting Tarrant's firearms licensing has been legally suppressed by the Royal Commission. So again, there were meant to be police officers checking that that firearms licensing. There was a specific person, and we now know that there was an actual person that was required to do this, but we're not allowed to actually say who he is. And of course, when you get into the issue of the Independent Complaints Authority and the inquiry they've had into the CIB, which focused very much on the Dunedin CIB, we've got a bit of a problem, Ben, because, you know, during the inquiry, which I think was Justice Goddard, they actually had one of the police officers under investigation. One of them was actually working for the IPCA on a separate case. Another one of them, they were found to hire a private investigation to try and dig up, dirt on a Supreme Court justice. And yes, the Supreme Court justice turned around and came out and said, well, actually, we've got a problem here. There's a really nasty culture going on here, but really not a lot seems to happen because we've got this, a lot of the very people and names and very controversial cases that you'll know, including the Scott Watson case and the David Bain case, who incidentally our shooter was living just around the corner from there. I don't know why I picked that street, but there you have it. These people keep making mistakes, but nothing happens to them, and said they just keep getting promoted. But we do know from Peter Williams' book, Stoned on Duty. It's his book, but it was ghostwritten by Bruce Ainslie, very, very good reporter, wrote lots and lots of very good investigative pieces for the listener. And he says, you know, he's making this point. He's saying, hey, Peter Williams, you know, don't push hell up hell, because the IPCA is just there to cover the cops and whitewash it. That's literally the word, quote unquote, and make sure that the cops don't get into trouble. And it's quite funny because, of course, you know, Jacinda Ardern, a lot of people, you know, they think they know her, but they don't really understand she worked for Tony Blair, one of the biggest neoliberals on the planet. She worked for the Better Business Bureau, but she also worked on the police review, which came about as a result of police corruption in the Met and the Flying Squad and the London Police in the 70s and the 80s, of which a lot of those detectives were actually sent to New Zealand and ended up basically running things like the Dunedin and other, you know, outlets, which became problems and continue to be problems ever since. But in the result, they turned around and said, well, you know what, we think there's the best solution. We think the UK police should actually incorporate the IPCA as their model to deal with police complaints. And fortunately, I think it didn't last that long, because even the English police will turn around and said, this is not fit for purpose. And I think it might have been about 2 or 3 years later, and then they had to revisit what they were actually doing, because the IPCA turned out to be not very good at stopping police corruption. But anybody in New Zealand could have told you that. And yet, that's where we are. New Zealand is one of the few countries in the world where we don't actually have an independent complaints authority, which is overseen by people that have no interest in the police. And as you've seen with things like, you know, Jervis McSkimmy and you know, Mike Sabin, and the list can actually it's getting quite long. And some of these cops are very, very senior, and nobody, no politician, not Labour, not National Party, wants to have a little bit, actually, let's say, look, it's time to actually sort this out, because this is, you know, they're starting to talk about now about starting up an organised crime ministry. until they sort out cleaning their own house, they're not going to be able to achieve anything. And unfortunately, remember in 1999, I wrote State Secrets. People were told there was no such thing as organized crime. I wrote that book, State Secrets, in 1999, and the end result of it was the next year, the police actually had a survey into organized crime to discover that there was nearly over 300 syndicates operating in New Zealand, and they set up an organized crime bureau, which I won't say I'm solely responsible, but I was a big instigator, which, you know, I'm sure my knighthood will be must have been lost in the mail. One of the things that we also discovered talking to my contact overseas was that another one of the things that he came up from the OIA requests and doing some other investigations was he found that we know there were three counterterrorism exercises taking place in Christchurch on that day, which is a hell of a coincidence. You know, Christchurch hasn't had any major significant terrorist attacks ever. And the one day that they had three events, it suddenly gets, you know, struck by an event. And they actually had a simulation. And in the simulation, what he found out is it actually involved the mosque specifically. That one of the key parts of that exercise or that simulation was the mosque, which is right opposite Hagley Park. And it's quite interesting too, because the other targets that are involved was St. Margaret's Hospital and basically a communication site that was up in Rickerton Road, which were also all involved on that particular terrorism exercise on that particular day. And where the cops that actually detained Brenton Tarrant and managed to kind of subdue him, drive him off the road and bring him down to the ground without a shot being fired, just happened to be, you know, just around the corner, and there, what a stroke of absolute luck. So that's kind of amazing. What an amazing coincidence. And it's very quite a disturbing one, especially because we know that the FBI were in Christchurch within a matter of hours. And we are now, because of Kash Patel's recent visit, that actually we don't have an FBI present in New Zealand. So it kind of asks the question, where do these guys come from? Was it maybe they flew over in a Learjet or whatever? But it seems to kind of builds a picture that they seem to be awfully ready and have all the right resources in town. And we have seen this happen in July 7th events in London subway bombing. We have seen this take place on 9/11 with Twin Towers. We've seen this take place in the Beslan bombing. It's actually pretty worrying. Like, I mean, you turn around and look at this mathematically, it's kind of like off the glitch. Now I'm going to hold it up there for the day. And we will we most certainly will. We'll come back and we'll give you some additional information about this Christchurch shooting revisited part two next week. We will also turn around and look at, we may not, but what I am going to give you a little bit of a clue here is that one of the things that are very much involved in Christchurch at the time was there were studies taking place at Lincoln University that was discovering that Christchurch's soil water, like that's out on the Canterbury Plains and Wairamaki Plains, Wairamaki Irrigation Limited was one of the companies very interested in the water area around that area. Go and have a look at them on the company files and have a look at who their directors are. But we know that while it was also happening, that they were very, very concerned about the water coming so far that very shortly people wouldn't be able to actually drink it. And this just 2 weeks before the shooting, we discovered that Leander Zell, the mayor of Christchurch City, tied New Zealand into things like Rockefeller Resilient Cities Program. We discovered that she'd been receiving donations from the Chinese, and there were questionable contacts about their access to her. And these were Chinese that were wanting to buy up Ocean Cloud, which is basically an artisan well, which is not far from Lincoln University. And that was some of the purest water in New Zealand. And it's the sort of water that would be worth a lot of money if you suddenly can't start drinking the available soil water because it's been contaminated with too much dairy effluent. And we're talking billions of dollars here, not millions, billions of dollars. But I think we'll hold it up there for the day. That's enough to wet your whistle. And we'll see you all next week on the Deadline Report. This is Kira Ben, Virgin Investigates, Kira Fresh FM, the coolest little radio station in the whole southern world and the southern hemisphere and everything that's south, and even cooler than the things in the north as well. Have a good week. Take care.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.